Well, this is my take on the on Onita. Good at wrestling and explosions. That was my that's my summary of Onita. Important because explosions.
It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Hello! Welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is my show, and we are back today with the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling. And in fact, this is episode 10. Last week I said it was episode 10, and I was wrong. Our Akira Maeda profile was in the wrong place. I do apologize for that. Didn't have time to figure it out until I put it on the playlist. Sorry. But we are at episode 10 now, and today's subject is interesting. Today's subject is Atsushi Onita, someone we've indulged in hinting at the career of as we've gone through the Beginner's Guide, but someone I wanted to give a full episode to round out our profiles, because he is a revolutionary wrestler for a wrestler who isn't necessarily that good. So to get me through this quagmire of an enigma wrapped in a parody is Chelsea Spollen. How are you doing, Mom?
I'm pretty good. I just had a bunch of caffeine, so I'm ready to do this.
Excellent. And if you're going to be wired for anyone, it's a Sushi Onita you want to be wired for, isn't it?
It is. Barbed wired, in fact.
Hey, yeah. A Sushi Onita is an interesting character. He didn't graduate high school. He was a dropout. He essentially turned up at the All Japan Pro Wrestling Dojo, I'm looking for a job, and was actually really the chosen one of Giant Baba. He was a guy who Baba decided to take under his wing, and he kind of figured, if I can make a pro wrestler out of this guy, I can make a pro wrestler out of anyone. And he did, and much like Tenryu, and much like Tsuruta, who we've talked about before, he was packaged up and sent off to Texas to meet the Funk brothers, Dory and Terry, for his initial training. Chelsea, we've talked about this with those two fine people. What do you think this, and we've kind of gone over the same ground here before, but what's your first impressions of Onita when you hear this story?
So I watched a couple of his matches in preparation for this podcast before I did any reading about him. Sometimes I do it the other way around. And I was surprised, frankly, that his style was so, for lack of a better word, kind of generic. Like, a bunch of the matches I watched, I'm like, well, the wrestling isn't really the thing that stands out, but the crowd still seems really invested in him, and his opponent gets to... he sort of becomes a good blank canvas for some of his opponents, if that makes sense. Like, he lets them do whatever it is that is going to make them look good, and he can go with it. He's very charismatic. He has a... It's not like a Ric Flair super cool type of charisma, but it's a, hey, that guy is interesting and has something going on and is really determined. I want to see what he's going to do next kind of thing. And yeah. He... sometimes, especially in the hardcore matches that he has, he seems a little bit crazy, and that's also interesting to watch.
Yeah, he's. I mean, you look at the early years, and there's a good match, a YouTube match online, which you can actually find, where him and Masafushi defeat Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee for the AWA Southern Heavyweight Tag Team titles in 1981. You can find it perfectly legal online, by the way. It's not part of the WWE library. You will not get into trouble for watching it. But you watch that, and you're right, they're a generic heel Japanese team, as you would expect to go over as top heels in Memphis.
Yep.
There's nothing he's doing in that match that is out of the ordinary or very special, you know. And similarly, all the way up until around about 1982, everything he's doing is pretty generic and ordinary. Nothing really stands out for him, does it?
No, not really. No. For a modern day comparison, I'm going to say pre-CZW Dean Ambrose.
Yeah, that's it. He's all right. He does where he can. Does where it says on the tin, basically.
Yep.
Now, Onita goes off to Texas, and he has learning excursions in Memphis and down in Mexico as well, where he learns a little bit of aerial work. Not much, just a bit of aerial work. Now, around about 1981, as we discussed before, the hottest division in the world was the New Japan Junior Heavyweight division, which had Tiger Mask, Davey Boy Smith, Tatsumi Fujinami, it had Bret Hart, it had the guys that kind of changed the wrestling business. Now, Giant Baba wasn't daft. He wanted a slice of that market as well. So being called back from his learning excursions, that Tsuchiya Inita was pressed into service as the new ace of the All Japan Junior Heavyweight Division, to which he kind of really took like a duck to water. Certainly that charisma helped him out, and the fans certainly believed in him. But as a wrestler, he wasn't really in the same league as the guys he was going up against, was he?
I mean, to be fair, a lot of those guys are really, 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 really good. But yeah, no, he's not. His wrestling isn't what stands out about him.
No, it's just the way he wrestles, or the way he presents himself. I think is probably the best way of going about it. Those matches in the early 80s, they weren't bad. It's just a mass of ordinariness, isn't it? It's
yes.
perfectly sustainable, perfectly watchable wrestling. Nothing's bad, nothing's terrible. The movesets aren't like, you know, flying around, and he's got some good guys to work with. Chavo Guerrero Sr. is his main opponent. They're wrestling over the NWA Junior Heavyweight Championship, and everything's kind of going along swimmingly. But he was just not as good as the other guys he was compared with in the other company, and this is part of the problem that All Japan had at the time. As you know, things had kind of wound down in the late 70s with the NWA agreement. This was one of their periods where they were rebooting and trying to get themselves back on track with everybody else, and he was all right. You know, he was all right, but he wasn't that great. So it was interesting to see how they kind of built this entire division around him and actually his tag team partner, Masafuchi, who would actually replace him as the ace in around about 1984, because rather abruptly, his career comes to an end. He has a knee injury and he can no longer wrestle. But that's not the last we hear of him, thankfully, or this podcast would be awfully short. Because in 1989, he decides he can have a comeback, and his knees have been restored to health, and he's ready to go. But he doesn't really want to go back to All Japan Pro Wrestling. He wants to try and do things small. And he wrestles for a company called Pioneer Senshi. Am I got the pronunciation right? Pioneer Senshi.
Senshi.
Pioneer Senshi. I kind of went halfway between the two. Pioneer Senshi, who was one of the very first independent wrestling companies in Japan. You know, and there was a lot of people who were kind of interested to see how this project would go. And it was a project that wasn't really New Japan, and it wasn't really All Japan, because it had a lot of guys who would work for both companies and had nothing to do. I think you could describe it as kind of Strong Style, kind of King's Road. It was kind of a hybrid approach. New Japan had an interest in it because the ring looked suspiciously like a New Japan ring. And mm-hmm. as New Japan and All Japan had their rings custom built for them, and no one else made wrestling rings in Japan, they had to get it from somewhere. Because it was really, really interesting. Because again, you get that follow-up of the fact he isn't doing anything specifically spectacular, but he is so popular for a new company at Currican Hall, doing like a completely brand new style of wrestling. But the fans really adore him. They really, really loved him, and they saw him as a style, as a star. You know, there was a guy, there was certainly room to maneuver, if you see what I mean.
So I wonder, like, how much of that is that, was it because he was sort of like an everyman in a world of guys who were sort of superhuman?
I think so, you know, because he's kind of just a little guy, isn't he? He's not, you know, you look at those pictures of the 1970s, he was like, he was Giant Baba's second. He was his ring attendant. And he's always kind of considered as part of that trio of Tenryu, Jumbo, and Ito were the chosen ones of Baba. But he looks so much smaller compared to Saruta and Tenryu because he's just a small guy. You know, he's just a high school dropout who just happened to drop lucky and get in with Giant Baba. And he's such an outsider in that circle of people. But you know, you're probably right. He's an everyman kind of guy, isn't he? And he kind of sees himself as this guy who's working against the establishment, especially when he doesn't go back to All Japan Pro Wrestling. You know, he's suddenly an outsider. And at the time, he was doing something completely different. Now, someone else who we talked about quite recently, Akira Maeda, was also having an awful lot of success with the UWF. And, you know, the UWF in 1989 was on their second run. They were filling arenas. Like we said last week, they actually filled the Tokyo Dome in 1990. So, you know, they were doing an awful lot of work, and Anita catches on to this, but he's trying to figure out a way of making that realism work for him. And that's the key thing with Anita. You know, he's trying to make things real, but on his terms. Now, The person that he kind of latches onto is a gentleman from the World Kickboxing Association, a fledgling MMA promotion that kind of started life in around about the same period, 1989. And the person that who is the headliner for that company is a guy called Masashi Aoyagi, who is not a wrestler. He's a kickboxer and martial arts practitioner who is pretty charismatic himself, I think.
Yeah, and they had good chemistry. Like, the interesting thing about, I watched either two or three of their matches in preparation for this podcast, and the interesting thing about it is Aoyagi clearly has a level of technical expertise that Onita doesn't bring to the table, but he doesn't walk all over Onita either. Like, when they lock up, they have that, like, tense, cool thing that good pairings in wrestling have, if that makes sense. Like, there's a fierce competitiveness between the two of them that works really well.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, really, for me, is, like, these matches, which are what become the first FMW matches, are wrestler versus martial artist, and Anita presents himself as a wrestler, but he wears kick pads for a guy who doesn't really kick. This is the first definition of Johnny kick pads. Like, for those there's kind of a semi-insider term, but Johnny kick pads is a name given to people who wear kick pads that never kick anybody. who wear them just because they look cool, and you could argue Anita was the first guy to do that. He certainly didn't have, like, the martial arts nous or expertise that certainly Aoyagi did, but that wasn't the point. The point was Anita's trying to get over how brave he is and how stoic he can be, and how long can he last with this master technician of mixed martial arts. That's the story he's trying to tell. And it's a long-form story as well. This is a story that lasts over three matches. Aoyagi defeats him in the first match, and then he defeats him again in the second match. And then they book a third match again at Currican Hall. But this time they do things differently. This time they take down the ropes and they replace them with barbed wire, which is now very interesting because this is not really pro wrestling anymore. And it's certainly not MMA anymore. It's something different. This is a whole new kind of thing going on.
And the barbed wire sort of becomes Onita's trademark.
Yes. Now, barbed wire has been around in wrestling matches for as long as, you know, people got a pair of wire cutters and trying to figure out something different for a gimmick match. And certainly his time in Texas and his time in Memphis would have introduced Onita to barbed wire, because there were lots of barbed wire matches in those territories. In fact, the first barbed wire match I ever saw was Stone Cold Steve Austin, who back then was Stunning Steve Austin, and he wrestled Gentleman Chris Adams in the Sportatorium in Dallas, Texas, in a barbed wire match to blow off their feud in their teacher versus student feud in 1991, I would think, off the top of my head. And that was the first time I saw a barbed wire match. Now, this wasn't like the barbed wire matches I saw in Texas or barbed matches I saw in Memphis. This was a no-rope barbed wire match. This is replacing the ropes with actual barbed wire itself, which changes the entire dynamic of how you tell a story in a wrestling match.
It makes it, it sort of moves all the action in the first half to the center of the ring and makes whatever happens in the second half very, very tense and usually very bloody.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. Did you see the match with the barbed wire with Aoyagi and Anita?
I didn't see that, but I did see the one he had with Hayabusa, and I did see the one he had, or one of the ones he had with Terry Funk.
Yeah, because this is where things get interesting, because, like, the FMW style starts to break out as a pro wrestling style. Like, originally it's a mixed martial arts and wrestling crossover in these first couple of matches, and then when they bring in the barbed wire, that changes the dynamic, because essentially the first match he has with Aoyagi is just a mixed martial arts match, and the barbed wire is only there for decoration, essentially. I think he takes one bump into the barbed wire.
And it looks very painful.
Yeah. Because it is. And so it's a starting point. But then there develops this entire wrestling style built around wrestling in barbed wire. And it's a development of the King's Road style. And the King's Road style, Giant Baba style, the strong storytelling, building upon maneuver, needing a set of maneuvers to tell your story, is ideally based for this particular style of wrestling, because you can't do half the things you did before. If you can't run the ropes anymore, you can't rely on rest holds because, you know, things of you can't take the pace up and down like you used to anymore. So this very deliberate storytelling style that Anita learnt under Giant Baba in the junior heavyweight division suddenly becomes really important. Of course, what overshadows everything is the fact that they're still landing in barbed wire, and it hurts.
Yes.
Because how much barbed wire street fights had you seen before this, Chelsea? Because this, I kind of am dubious in one sense of like encouraging people to go watch this stuff, because it is not for everyone. And I will say that right now. If you're going to get put off by blood, don't watch it.
So I had seen some. I've seen a couple of the famous Joshi matches that involve barbed wire. I've seen, like, I watched like Combat Toyota and Megumi Kudo, the like electrified barbed wire match. I've seen some CZW stuff that's more modern. But yeah, it's really bloody. There's kind of no way to watch it without being concerned that somebody's going to lose an eye.
Yeah. That's fairly reasonable to say. Yeah. I mean, to me, it's, I enjoy those matches for the drama. I'm not particularly fond of the violence, but I certainly enjoy those matches for the drama. And I would argue that the Megumi Kudo Combat Toyota no rope exploding barbed wire match,
kind of the pinnacle of the art form.
Yeah, it was absolutely phenomenal. It was the best, because those two were far better wrestlers than the other people they were in that have done this with. And I'm hoping we do get to review the FMW 5th anniversary show with it on. I'm saying we will.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, so we can see that. I mean, and also it's very important for Anita's matches. But there starts to be this kind of, like, the style evolves. And also there is a cult of personality based around Onita that seems to follow through. You know, and the story of Aoyagi becomes the base principle of all stories told involving Onita after this. You know, there is a lot of feuds that begin with one match that Onita loses, then he loses again, and then he finally gets his comeback win. Or he'll lose one and win one. This becomes a story of losses and recovery. This is, you know, this is a guy who's always searching for redemption in his stories.
And, you know, I feel like a lot of the reason that you watch three of those matches, that you'll sit through three of them, is because he's so determined and he's so tough.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's not like he's MMA tough either, is it?
No, it's not. It's not, I spent the most time in the gym and I have the best sponsorship and I, you know, and my muscles flex really appealingly as I walk to the ring. It's not that kind of thing. He looks like an ordinary guy who's willing to take a terrible beating. And, like, I mean, one of the matches I watched with him for this podcast, somebody chokes him. I think it's Terry Funk chokes him with a piece of barbed wire.
Yeah.
And he takes it.
Yeah.
For, like, 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah. And at one point, he swallowed barbed wire. And they actually had to surgically remove it through his throat.
Ugh.
Yeah. That nearly cost him his voice box. You know, he's on another level, and he could arguably be on another level of crazy, because he's still doing this now. You know, he's still having exploding barbed wire matches, and I don't want to get to the, like, how they up the ante just yet, because that could put people off entirely. but, you know, these early days of FMW, and that's what the company becomes. It starts off as Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling. Then slowly it becomes FMW. The initials are the important, not what they stand for.
Right.
But it's a really innovative company in the sense of, you know, that lots of people consider FMW to be a one-trick pony. It's just Anita. But you look at the guys that came out of FMW and the women that came out of FMW. You have, you know, Masato Tanaka is one of the early trainees. Hayabusa is one of the early trainees. There's two guys who really did revolutionize their particular portion of the industry. Masato Tanaka was an incredible technical brawler who had a real influence on guys like Tomohiro Ishii, on guys you see in wrestling today, Shibata, Goto. You know, and Hayabusa was off the page as an aerial wrestler. He was doing things that I've never seen anyone do. You know, he was... His absolute sure-footedness in the air as an aerial wrestler was just incredible for his time period. And there's only, like, Manami Toyota and Sabu who could get anywhere near him for grace in the air. You know,
yeah.
Anita suddenly, over the space between 1989 and 1993, a four-year period, really, essentially goes from being an indie darling to being the biggest draw in Japanese wrestling, bar none. You know, and he takes a lot of people with him. And that four-year period is a fascinating time in pro wrestling history, because at the same time, you've got All Japan Pro Wrestling have grounded the King's Road style. There's been the mass exodus of Tenryu and the SWS guys. You've focused on the four pillars. You have Kobashi, Kawada, Teiyu, and Misawa. The true King's Road style that we all talk about starts. In New Japan Pro Wrestling, you've got the Three Musketeers are finally coming through. They're the guys who are main eventing now. Fujinami's taking a back step. Muto, Hashimoto, and Chono are the guys that are carrying the company forward. In All Japan Women, as we will discuss in a couple of weeks' time, the crew of Manami Toyota, Akira Hokuto, Aja Kong, Toshiyu Yamada, the greatest pro wrestlers who ever lived, are just fermenting what they're going to be doing in the next 4 years. All of the great things that are happening in pro wrestling are happening in this period. And here's a guy who was a high school dropout, who isn't necessarily book smart, but he understands wrestling, has an incredible wrestling IQ, isn't the greatest wrestler ever, by a long stretch of the imagination, and yet he finds a way of making himself just as important a draw as Teiyu, or Misawa, or Kobashi, or Muto. How does he do this?
After he was done with wrestling the either the first or the second time, I think he temporarily became a politician. And he's just got that X factor of he wants people to care about him, but not in a way where it feels like he's trying too hard. He takes a lot of risks to get your attention. And he's so determined to be captivating that it just kind of comes through. I don't really know. It's an X factor. You can't totally define it.
Yeah, I mean, there's some examples of that, like in his everyday life. Well, in his life, like he celebrated a tag win in a no rope double hell death exploding barbed wire match, tag team championship win. I think it was with Tanaka. It might have been Hayabusa. By jumping off a bridge into the Kawasaki River. If you know anything too much about the Kawasaki River, you don't want to be in the Kawasaki River with open wounds.
You'll get really sick.
Yes, and he contracted hepatitis B and was in hospital for quite a long time. I think he held the world record for having more stitches than anyone else ever.
Wow.
You know, it wasn't always plain sailing as well. He did take some education. He did take some promotional risks that other people didn't. For instance, there was the great storyline there. He was trying to negotiate matches with Carlos Colon in Puerto Rico to take back to Japan. And he basically gimmicked an angle with Invader One, who was the person who was largely led to believe killed Bruiser Brody. Now, Bruiser Brody was an absolutely beloved figure in Japan. You know, he was as big a star, wrestling star, as any Gaijin has ever been in Japan. And kind of echoing this stabbing incident that was a very real-life tragedy was not something that went down well in Japan, and was certainly something that did not go down well in Puerto Rico as well. He ended up arrested and having his passport taken away from him. So, you know, he's a guy who's willing to take big risks to do this. The first couple of things is, I mean, like the matches with Aoi Yagi, a fair to middling wrestler versus a martial artist isn't something necessarily that's going to draw, is it?
No. You know, a lot of times, in fact, it's really boring because the martial artist just beats the crap out of the other guy and wins.
So, you know, you've got a risk there. That's a big risk, but he manages to get past that risk and then he builds a story around it. And he has his falls, but he has his wins as well. Like, I can also remember there's one match where the big heel manager of the time brings in a guy wearing bandages all over his body, and they announce it as Mr. Pogo. They hadn't signed Mr. Pogo yet, but they wanted to make a promise for the next card he would be there. So they got a guy. So that's a pretty big risk if you don't land his signing, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like he's a guy who's willing to take mad risks to move his company forward. And you look at the fact that they were getting 1,500 people at Currican Hall in 1989, yet they sell out Kawasaki Baseball Stadium, 36,000 people, for the third anniversary show.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, this is a phenomena in the hottest period in Japanese pro wrestling history. You know, and certainly at the time, New Japan were getting big crowds than WWE were in that time period. That period between, what was it, 93 to 95, New Japan were drawing more people than the WWF was. All Japan were making twice as much money as the WWF was, and it was arguable that FMW were probably on comparable money on their big show, certainly, to what WWF was doing, because Japan was the hottest wrestling market in the world at the time, and they had the money to spend, and the production values were there, and they were drawing money left, right, and center. And it's amazing to me that Anita finds his niche in this particular market and this particular style, and developing this style. What do you think of, like, those opportunities? How can you make those opportunities for yourself work? And why did they work?
Oof, that's tough. It's hard to put your finger on it, because Onita was innovative mostly just in the sense that he was willing to do stuff and eager to do stuff that other people would just never consider. And he sort of, like you mentioned before, pulled everybody else along with him. I think you mentioned, you know, taking advantage of those opportunities, but I think, like, he created those opportunities for himself.
Yeah.
It's like, didn't he have the first, it wasn't just the first barbed wire match in Japan. It was, or no ropes barbed wire match in Japan. It was also the cage bomb matches and the time bomb exploding barbed wire matches. I mean, that's who is even willing to do that? Who even thinks of that to begin with? Like, who says, oh, I want to take this thing that's already inherently really dangerous that could end my career and make it more so? You know, I mean, it's kind of like he's so crazy, in a sense, that you're sort of forced to respect him.
That's the thing, I guess. It is just like forcible respect, because all the guys that end up working in FMW end up working this barbed wire style, whether they want to or not. You know, this is the way it becomes. You know, this is standardized. Onita doesn't wrestle in regular wrestling matches very often after this point. You know, after about 1991, every match you see him in is in a street fight or a barbed wire match, because he's usually in the main event, because he's the biggest draw for the company, and usually that's the way it is. So his regular wrestling match was a no-rope barbed wire match. You know, and then if they wanted something special, they'd up the ante with electrified barbed wire. And then if it's a really, really big match, it's electrified barbed wire with exploding boards at ringside. And then they get to the point of electrified barbed wire. And then you get into the whole concept of the double hell death match. The electrified barbed wire exploding time bomb double hell death match, which is the first arena filler at Kawasaki Baseball Stadium. Which is a smart place to have it, because Kawasaki is only a couple of bullet train stops from Tokyo. So everyone came down from Tokyo. Kawasaki is a massive hotbed for industrial work, as you'd imagine, because the Kawasaki's factory is there. basically every Suzuki and Kawasaki motorcycle is built in that area. And the baseball stadium becomes the home of FMW. And, you know, that time bomb match, the first serious matches you start to see where it becomes more about trying to be a spectacle draw. Certainly Goto's the first. There's Tarzan and Goto, who's the first serious draw for FMW. He was quite a big draw for All Japan Pro Wrestling. And he's promised a top-line program with Anita if he switches sides to FMW and does so. And then he becomes Anita's right-hand guy as second babyface. And then after that, you have got Mr. Pogo, who is a former New Japan guy. And remarkably, Mr. Pogo and Anita have their massive blow-off exploding boards barbed wire match in a car park. They build a
temp- so who even thinks of doing that in the first place?
Yeah,
that's so crazy.
we can't find a stadium to house us. We can't do exploding stuff in Currican Hall because we might demolish the building, so we have to do it outside. So let's find a really big car park, put some bleachers in. There's your arena. And it is just like how they were defined as, you know, create your own wrestling company, figure out how you're going to do wrestling on your terms and doing it the way you want to without anyone else telling you're not doing it right. So essentially they're just like, we haven't got a stadium, let's build our own. And I can remember I watched the whole of that card as well. And at the opening of the show, the ring announcer, who ended up being the actual Shinichi Ocho, who actually ended up being the owner of FMW in the end, he's allowing the fans to set off the explosives to show that they're real. And you've got fans setting off explosives and scaring themselves to death, you know, in these landmines that are filtered into the boards. And then the next major kind of like feud series that they have, I guess, it really is the feud that Anita has with Terry Funk, and that winds up at the third anniversary show, which is something really quite special. You know, there are other things that go on in this time period, but certainly this is where Anita starts getting taken very seriously as a great pro wrestler, or certainly as a great draw, if not a great pro wrestler.
It's the matches with Funk are really interesting too. Like, I mean, Funk is one of the guys who helped train him, so there's a similarity to some of how they, you know, set up some of their moves and go into their moves. They're very evenly matched, but it's sort of like a clash of two everyman types. And one of the ones I watched was the no rope exploding barbed wire time bomb death match.
Yeah, that's the big one. In that one, everything is set up to be so dramatic. So you've got, just to give you the rundown of what actually happens in this match, because it's well worth just explaining it from top to bottom. So you have your ring, you take down the ropes, you replace that with barbed wire, you then electrify the barbed wire, and in each ring post corner you fill it with C4. Yeah, that's C4, and you wire that up. And it's all set to go off at 15 minutes. And at the 10-minute mark, you have an air raid siren goes off for 5 minutes to impress upon you the fact that the ring's going to explode at the 15-minute mark. And to top off all of that, the referee's in a fire suit.
Yep.
Not just like a basic fire suit like a car racer would wear. I mean a proper fire suit.
The big silver protective ones with the face coverings.
Yeah, the one that makes you look like, you know, you're just about to walk into a toxic waste dump. That one. And they have proceeded to have a wrestling match, which is actually, given the environment, a very, very good wrestling match.
It's very, very tense. The crowd is super into it and has no idea what's going to happen and seems partly excited and partly terrified. And there's, I mean, you never see so much tension when two people are just locked up pushing each other back and forth. But yeah. It's very strangely emotional.
Yeah, because that's the thing. You don't expect necessarily to get caught up. When you watch wrestling matches, you get caught up in the you're supposed to get caught up in the actual story, aren't you? That's the idea. And you don't
really get invested in it.
Yeah, you get invested in it. And you don't necessarily think you're going to get invested in this because it's such an outlandish idea. But about 2 minutes in, you're locked into this match. You are like this. You don't care about anything else going on around you. This is what you're watching, and you're locked into this, and this is going to be cool. And you don't know why it's going to be cool, but it's going to be cool. And it's a very bizarre feeling. And I kind of like the ultra-violence of it. I can understand a lot of people will find it distasteful, and I can't disagree with you. I don't necessarily think it was particularly healthy for the wrestling business either. But equally, like, if you learn anything from these matches, is the ability to make a watchable story in such a limited environment. Certainly that first match with Pogo that I saw, Pogo is so good in this environment. You know, Mr. Pogo was born to do this job. And the first time I saw Pogo was on a Puerto Rico card in the late 80s. And he was in a regular wrestling match. He was a brilliant, brilliant heel and really understood how to make an audience work. And you have to be good in Puerto Rico because the fans will just kill you if you aren't.
Have the most vicious wrestling fans in the world.
Yeah, so if you're a heel, the heels want them to kill him, but you know you just won't survive in Puerto Rico unless you're actually some good, because you know. So and Pogo was so good in this environment, and then you know Terry Funk, who understands limitations so well, because essentially Funk's kind of like redefining a style there, isn't he? You know, he's the one that taught Anita how to use barbed wire properly, and then they're trying to make this great artistic statement. Because Terry Funk at this point, you know, he wasn't the draw necessarily he had been down the years, certainly since his first retirement in All Japan in 1981. But he was still a massive, massive star, and yeah. Especially in Japan.
The audience reacts to the match like both of those guys are big stars. It's got that, like, heated, excited feeling even before anybody touches the ropes, you know? And then you get that tension and that energy, and then I think it's like 3 minutes in when Funk whips Onita back into the barbed wire, and it's electrified. So Onita doesn't just get cut, he's got like black burns on his shoulders.
Yeah.
When he comes away that he then, you know, has on him for the rest of the match. And he still takes bumps with those burns on him. It's very, very tense and very hard to watch, but also it's like watching a car crash. You kind of can't stop looking at it.
No, it just draws you in, you know, and it's also, you know, when you think about like the innovation of those particular matches and the innovation of the company in general, you know, this is the first mixed gender wrestling company, and Anita can't pick the biggest stars in women's wrestling because they all work for other people. So he goes and finds himself some stars. He gets hold of a dojo. They started FMW Dojo pretty quickly in about 1990. And he has a lot of young women in his dojo. But he has no star quality. So he has to find somebody. So he finds Combat Toyota and Megumi Kudo to wrestle. And we talked about this on the Dream Slam shows. Megumi Kudo was a kindergarten teacher who'd given up on her dream as being a pro wrestler. And Combat Toyota was an independent wrestler who was working for anybody who'd ever. And they both get picked to go to FMW by Anita. Anita goes to work. I'm sure Anita, the story was that Anita went to see Kudo at work to persuade her to become a pro wrestler again.
Yeah.
And they invade FMW as a group. The 1986 AJW graduate Reigen Amada invade FMW. And then Kudo actually ends up turning face because Amada attacks her at the end of a match in Currican Hall. So that they then have Toyota, or Norio Toyota, as she first started out in FMW. And then Megumi Kudo becomes her main face opponent. They had a street fight in 1991, which may have been the very first like come-as-you-are street fight between women in Japan, if I remember correctly. Wow. Yeah, I think I'm sure it was 1990 and 1991, and it was the main event of their own shows, because in the end FMW were running two or three shows at a time, so they would have an all female show and an all male show, or they'd have mixed shows together as well. And in 1990, Toyota and Kudo had the I'm sure it was one of the first come as you are street fights, and it was really really entertaining, and it was done in a public park. They held a, you know, again back to this like, let's just have a match right here, damn it, in a 1930s musical kind of style of way of going about things. So, you know, there's incredible innovation, because once you've broken one rule of pro wrestling, why would you stop there?
It's there's a fearlessness there, isn't it? Of like, hey, we're gonna try this, and we care if you like it in the sense that we need you to buy tickets, but we also don't care if it's disastrous. We're just going to try it anyway.
Yeah, this is it. You know, and the next point is you've got a heel tag team of Rick Bogner, Mike Awesome, and Horace Hogan. You know, three names that you'd never like put together. Rick Bogner, Titan, who was fake Razor Ramon, if I can remember correctly. Mm. You've got Mike Awesome, who's Mike friggin' Awesome. And Horace Hogan, or, you know, Horace, as he was known, Hulk Hogan's nephew. And they were big, big stars in this time period. They were the FMW six-man street fight tag team champions. And they had some pretty classic matches in this period. There's other innovations as well, like Anita books what I absolutely adore is possibly the most ridiculous set of gimmick matches ever, if the ones we've talked about aren't already ridiculous enough. In his feud with Tiger Jeet Singh, they have an exploding no-rope barbed wire time bomb match in a jungle where they took a ring out to the jungle and he wrestled Tiger Jeet Singh to set the feud off. It was a VHS-only release. And he lost to Tiger Jeet Singh, and then they took it to the next anniversary show where he had his rematch with Tiger Jeet Singh. There was, if I can remember correctly, Battle Royal in the Bay, where they floated a ring on a pontoon and had a Battle Royal. And once you got thrown out of the ring, you had to swim to shore.
Amazing.
Yeah. the no rope exploit. Right. This is possibly the best one, was the no rope exploding a sea mine match. Right. Okay. So
you're kidding me.
No, what they did was they had a big Olympic swimming stadium.
Okay.
They put the ring on a pontoon in the middle of the swimming pool, and they put sea mines in the water around the ring. So anyone who was thrown off the ring, landed in the water, set off a sea mine.
Wow.
There is just like, once you've opened your mind past this little window of restriction, we can do what the fuck we want to do. And they ran with that. They just ran with it. And that swimming pool stadium was absolutely sold out. We'll actually have to do that card as a review, because it is hilarious, as you can probably imagine. Not great wrestling, but as far as spectacle is concerned, because you can find it. It is available. Most of these FMW things are available, actually. You can find them on videos or DVDs somewhere. But it was just like, this made me laugh. It was just, this is just too ridiculous to be true, you know. And
I have a question, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Speaking of too ridiculous to be true, one of the wrestling things that I always think associate with hardcore wrestling, like most American fans who watch WWE, is I always think about ECW as being the foundation of a lot of the stuff that that we see now in promotions like CZW. What, if any, is the connection there between the popularity of the hardcore stuff in Japan in the 90s? Because we're talking about, like, right now at the point we're at, we're talking about, like, 92, 93, right? And yeah. ECW was founded in 92.
Right. There is an awful lot of evidence that would suggest Paul Heyman, well, I won't say borrowed ideas, borrowed the philosophy of FMW. You know, we talk about ECW being a philosophy and a state of mind and, you know, the Kool-Aid and all the things we associate with ECW, but the philosophy was very similar to FMW. Mm. FMW couldn't afford the big stars. They had a limited budget. Well, there's a bunch of guys who Baba won't work with, Inoki won't work with. They're currently floating around the international scene. They're pretty hardcore. They aren't afraid to get hurt.
Right.
They want to tell artistic stories, and they probably won't work. They'll probably work for less money than, say, if we tried to hire Tenryu. You know,
right.
Eventually they got Tenryu, but you know, they were working on a limited budget. They had to have stars. Tiger Jeet Singh is a good example. No one in their right mind ever wants to work with Tiger Jeet Singh because he's a selfish asshole. And you know, they managed to work a series with Tiger Jeet Singh. They got hold of. You know, the Sheik, the original Sheik, who was damn near 70. He was 63 years old. And him and Anita and Tarzan Goto had a tag match with Sabu and the Sheik, in which the Sheik nearly died because they had the first fire match, which was essentially they replaced the ropes with logs. Like, it was like telegraph poles, really, which was silly. You know, and then they douse them in kerosene and set fire to them. And
right.
It's like, well, surely you've not realized that there's an awful lot of fire there. You don't need that much fire to prove your point.
Indeed.
And of course, after about 10 seconds, you couldn't see anything anyway because it was just smoke everywhere.
Right.
Yeah, it was just ridiculous. And of course, obviously, Sabu and Goto and Anita could get the hell out of the way, but the Sheik, who was 64 years old and wasn't moving particularly quickly by that point, couldn't really get out of the way fast enough, and he went to hospital with smoke inhalation.
Yikes.
However, he did have a perfectly reasonable match and feud with the Sheik over the Sheik's US championship, the old one from the Bobra Brazil in Detroit days, because the Sheik was massively over in Japan from the visits he'd made in the 1960s. He was still a big name, but he was relatively cheap because he was no longer a draw in Detroit, and he was happy
right.
to go to Japan and get the payday, and the Japanese fans respected him, and they loved him, and they even turned the Sheik face.
Wow.
You know? And they took Sabu with them, who is the Sheik's nephew, who the Sheik was trying to get on shows. And that's really where Sabu starts his career of table breaking and, you know, the whole thing there. But that basic philosophy of, we haven't got a lot of money, how are we going to get creative with the money we have, is what Heyman took. The actual blueprint of the violence, I'm sure it was obviously influenced by FMW, but I think it was more down to, again, that philosophy of, what have we got? Well, we've got bloodthirsty fans who hate everything. So we need to give them a product they will actually enjoy.
Hmm.
You know, that's my kind of take on it. It's like, he took the philosophy of FMW of, throw the rule book out the window. And Paul Heyman's far more conservative than Anita was. Everyone thinks Heyman is like, you know, he was wrestling's mad scientist. And he was, to an extent.
Well, everybody compares him to Vince McMahon. If you're comparing somebody to Vince McMahon, who is even a little bit creative, then yes, they're going to look like, I should say even a little bit more creative, then they're going to look like a mad scientist by comparison.
Yeah, but Anita just literally, not just threw the rule book out the window, he went downstairs, tore it up, jumped up and down on it, took it upstairs and threw it out the window again.
And set it on fire.
And then set it on fire with a time bomb. After wrapping it in barbed wire. So, you know, so they just did everything differently. And the daft thing is, the core principles of it is still this King's Road style that he was taught to him by Giant Baba. Baba hated him, by the way, because he had made a living for himself without being in All Japan Pro Wrestling, and Baba did not like garbage wrestling whatsoever.
Right. That makes sense.
But equally, he becomes massively influential. The IWA, Victor Quiñones' promotion that starts up a couple of years down the line, would not exist without FMW existing first. They are innovative in themselves. You know, Gedo and Jado have their first main event run in Wing, which was a predecessor to the IWA. The monster wrestler storylines of Jason the Terrible, Freddy Krueger, and Leatherface start in Wing and then IWA. So all these innovations that come out of the garbage promotions, for want of a better phrase, the hardcore promotions of Japan, really start with Anita. But like the whole idea of wrestling being different and throwing the rule book out the window, that starts with Anita as well. And it's like it's like a slow, gradual thing. Like, let's have wrestler versus mixed martial arts. Let's have wrestler versus mixed martial arts. Let's take away the ropes. Let's electrify the ropes. Why don't we put a landmine in? Why don't we put a bomb in? You know, it's a slow, you can see it suddenly, it's like a piano escalate, piano falling downstairs. It may start slowly, but once you got going, it's going to start to stop the momentum.
Once it gets going, how do you stop it?
Yeah, exactly. Now, there is a couple of ways you can stop it, like Anita retiring, which was one of the things that did happen. And I think probably as we look at these cards in the next few episodes of The Beginner's Guide, we can probably go back and look at some FMW cards and pick things apart more directly so you can see where things came from. But I thought it was important to have this discussion today to just kind of outline what Anita was, because he's just something else in Japanese wrestling, where we consider everything to be so conservative. He's a guy who just felt so out of the box and so different.
And I think he doesn't totally fit the template of a lot of what's really popular right now at this moment in 2017 when we're recording this podcast. Like, I don't think a guy like Onita, who was necessarily that innovative, would be able to make his stamp on wrestling now. Do you know what I mean? Like, even with that charisma, I don't know if they would let somebody like that become a TV star right now.
No, I know what you mean. And you couldn't force yourself on the public the same way he did. There's a certain playboy element to him, which kind of like is he's kind of the last gasp of his era. I'll get to that bit in a minute because I know where you're laughing. In the same way, you're never going to get another car driver that's like AJ Foyt, because AJ was a product of his era. Double tough, old school. Drove cars on the weekend and worked his way up through the ranks. Just a tough old bastard, because you could be a tough old bastard in that era. You're never going to get another motorcycle racer like Barry Sheen, because you can't smoke, drink, and sleep around that much anymore. It's just not the done thing. It's considered unseemly.
Right, you'll get punished for
you'll get punished for acting in that manner, you know. And there's loads of guys. And Anita's one of those guys. You can't act like that anymore. You can't rally against the system and just trash everything wrestling ever did and then rebuild it from the ground up in your own image. You just can't do that anymore. Partly because he was a guy who did it. But you couldn't imagine someone like, say Nakamura comes back from WWE. He's done his 2 years contract. It doesn't go anywhere. He's quite happy to leave the company, and WWE say, okay, fine, you can go back to Japan. And he decides to take the money he's earned in WWE to start his own promotion. I don't see that happening. I see him going back to New Japan and starting again. That's what I see happening. But even someone as gregarious and as individual as Nakamura wouldn't go out of his way to like rebuild something new.
Asuka tried it once, right?
Yeah, Asuka.
At one point?
Asuka kind of, she had a couple of goes at it. You know, she really wanted to revitalize like Shoot style in promotions in women. She developed her own manifesto. And tried to get away from like comedy in wrestling, trying to get away from spots that were obviously undefended spots. She wanted it to be more like a Shoot promotion. And her first, I think after she left Neo, the first promotion she had was very Shoot orientated. They called it Kana 2. And, you know, there was only a limited number of people who wanted to wrestle that style, though. And it was only had a limited appeal. And her later independent work is much more mainstream. There's a lot more comedy in it, funnily enough. You know, and she starts promoting for herself, and it becomes much more of a traditional wrestling product. But I guess that's growing pains as a promoter. She tried to redesign what Joshi was all about, and Joshi fans just didn't take to it, or the way they wanted her to, put it that way. So yeah, it gets harder to book against the system, because you can't make as many risks because you're not going to make as much money. There is, even New Japan, the biggest promotion in Japan now, doesn't get 36,000 fans into a building.
Right.
So we will never see the likes of Anita again, and arguably you maybe don't want to, and there's other reasons why as well, which I'm sure we'll get to exploring. there is the argument to say, once you've done absolutely everything you possibly can do, why would anyone watch it again?
Well, also, I mean, we're watching an era of wrestling where there's constantly a lot of talk and speculation about the health and safety and well-being of the wrestlers. And that's not bad.
No, it's a good thing.
That's a good thing. That's something that should have happened long before it did. But it's not just that hardcore style has been phased out in a lot of instances. You're just not going to get wrestlers who are going to look at the money that they could make doing something else, who are willing to give that up and also give up, you know, possibly like 10 to 15 years worth of their career to do hardcore matches like that.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who kind of, Young Kasai is probably the best example, Isami and a few others that have made a career out of hardcore wrestling, but it's because they want to be hardcore wrestlers, not because they want to be, if they wanted to be main event draws, they'd have gone to the New Japan Dojo, or, you know, they would have found a way of getting, you know, to be without having to put their skin on the line, if you see what I mean. So, you know, Anita's such a bizarre individual. If he didn't exist, you'd have to invent him, I guess. He's one of those people that's just, he saw wrestling in a completely different light to everybody else. And yeah, he did create something very, very special. Whether that thing he created is worth anything to the wrestling industry now, or is it a blueprint for something that will come in the future, I don't know. Because of the hardcore promotions that we have now, Big Japan Pro Wrestling, and Freedoms, they do okay, but they're not even on the, well, I mean, Big Japan is doing a lot better than it used to, and it's kind of like on a par with Noah and All Japan at the moment.
Right.
So, you know, but it's certainly not filling, you know, Anita was the first person to get a $100,000 gate at Currican Hall, a 2,000 seater stadium, which will show you how much money they could make when he was at his absolute peak, especially on his retirement tour. So, yeah, and there's lots of other things as well as negatives as far as FMW is concerned. Certainly its involvement with the Yakuza, which we'll get to at the end of the FMW story in a few weeks' time, is sad, to say the least. But, you know, they were doing something completely different. They were changing the way... We've talked a lot about in these episodes about how Akira Maeda changed the way we looked at pro wrestling, and he certainly did. And with certainly Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask and that New Japan Junior Heavyweight Division we talked about at the beginning of this episode certainly changed the way wrestling was perceived. And arguably, Anita would not have existed without them, because obviously it was Baba saying, we need a new ace to carry this division forward, and Anita's my guy. Right. But certainly Anita in this period is absolutely and positively redefining what pro wrestling can be. I'm not necessarily sure whether it's a positive or a negative. I know a lot of people had careers they wouldn't have had. Horace Hogan would not have become a star in WCW without it, because it was sheer nepotism, but he was actually probably an all-round better wrestler than his uncle was. He didn't have anywhere near the charisma that Hulk Hogan did. Mm. You know, Masato Tanaka, still going to this day, a phenomenal talent that had, you know, was founded because of FMW. Mike Awesome, a guy who never reached his potential, and that wasn't necessarily his fault.
Right.
Sabu, Hayabusa, Combat Toyota's career would have fizzled and not gone anywhere. Makumi Kudo was another one. Bad Nurse Nakamura, Shark Tikiso, you know, all of these wrestlers had careers that would not have existed and put together bodies of work that would not have existed without Tsuchi Anita.
Mm.
And maybe that's his lasting legacy. But we will examine his legacy in some of the shows we will look at, some of the FMW shows. I desperately want to do everyone looking at that exploding swimming pool match, because I think I'd be intrigued to see what the Alexes and Marcus have to say about that.
I mean, how do you not talk about an exploding swimming pool match?
Yeah, we'll have to get that. When we get to 1996 or whenever it was, we'll have to look up that card and make sure we all watch it, because that could be something else. But that could do us for the Troopany show today. Thank you very much, Chelsea. This has been a fascinating chat about a wrestler that is just, it just fascinates me and fascinates a lot of other people. I talked to Finlay Martin when we was doing the wrestling history shows yesterday, and I said we was doing this podcast, and he said Anita is such a fascinating guy, and I think that's what we found out today.
I agree. Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Yeah. And you can talk to her at Chelsea Comics on Twitter. You can also find her at shoulders_up on Twitter, where she live tweets sometimes, gives you a bit of a sneak peek of what's happening on the Troopany show, like you did yesterday, about what's happening in a couple of weeks' time. Next week will be the New Beginnings reviews, which pretty much all of us will be on that show because we all like to talk about New Japan. So we will be with you back again next week. We will return to the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Pro Wrestling in a couple of weeks' time where we will start our second chapter and we'll be looking at individual shows and recommendations from things you could watch from All Japan Women, from New Japan Pro Wrestling, from All Japan Pro Wrestling, from FMW, from the IWA, and all the great promotions of Japanese wrestling's golden era. Second chapter of the Beginner's Guide to Japanese Professional Wrestling. Thank you, take care, and we'll see you next week. Bye!